his chin. The brigand dropped his sabre and jerked the knife from his throat with both hands, spurting blood, but Angoulême sprang up to kick him in the chest and knocked him to the ground. Meanwhile, Geralt had struck another bandit. Cahir hacked the next one to death. Something shaped like a slice of watermelon dropped from the robber's skull after a powerful blow of his Nilfgaardian blade. The last thug fled and jumped onto his horse. Cahir tossed up his sword, seized it by the blade, and hurled it like a javelin, striking the brigand right between the shoulder blades. The horse neighed and jerked its head, sat hard on its haunches, and stamped its hooves, dragging the corpse over the red mud, its hand tangled up in the reins. The whole thing took less than 5 heartbeats.
"Hey!" yelled somebody from among the buildings. "Help! Help! Murder! Vicious killers!"
"Troops! Call out the troops!"
shouted another miner, shooing away children who, as is the immemorial custom of all the world's children, had appeared from nowhere to watch and get in the way.
"Someone run and call the army!"
Angoulême picked up her knife, wiped and sheathed it.
"Let them run by all means,"
she shouted back, looking around.
"What is it, quarrymen? Are you blind or what? That was self-defense. They fell on us, the bloody thugs. Don't you know them? Haven't they done you enough harm? Haven't they extorted enough from you?"
She sneezed loudly. Then she tore the purse from the belt of the still, twitching Novisad and leaned over Yeryl.
"Angoulême."
"What?"
"Leave it."
"Why should I? It spoils. Short of money."
"Angoulême."
"You,"
a voice suddenly shouted.
"This way, please."
3 men stood in the open doorway to a barrack serving as the tool store. 2 of them were heavies with low foreheads and closely cropped hair of undoubtedly limited intelligence. The 3rd, the one who'd shouted to them, was a very tall, dark-haired, handsome man.
"I couldn't help overhearing the conversation preceding the incident," the man said. "I found it hard to believe you'd killed the Witcher, thinking it empty bragging."
"I don't think that now. Step inside."
Angoulême drew an audible intake of breath. She glanced at the Witcher and nodded barely perceptibly. The man was a half-elf. The half-elf Skiru was tall, well over 6 feet. He wore his dark hair tied on his neck in a ponytail falling down his back. His mixed blood was betrayed by his eyes, which were large, almond-shaped and yellowish-green like a cat's.
"So, you killed the Witcher,"
he said again, smiling repulsively.
"Forestalling Hormasdragon, also called Nightingale? Fascinating, fascinating. Put simply, I ought to pay you 50 florins, the 2nd instalment, which means Stragon received his 210 florins for nothing, for you surely can't suppose he'll give it up."
"How I settle accounts with Nightingale is my business," said Angoulême, sitting on a crate and swinging her legs. "The contract on the Witcher was a one-off commission, and we carried out that commission. We did, not Nightingale. The Witcher's in the ground. His company, all 3 of them, are in the ground. In other words, job done."
"At least that's what you claim. How did it happen?"
Angoulême kept swinging her legs.
"I'll write my life story when I'm old," she declared in her usual impudent tone. "I'll describe how this, that and the other took place. You'll have to hold on till then, Mr. Skiru."
"It shames you that much, then," the half-breed remarked coldly. "So you did the deed foully and treacherously."
"Does that bother you?" Geralt asked.
Skiru looked at him intently.
"No," he answered after a moment. "Geralt, the Witcher of Rivia, didn't deserve a better fate. He was a simpleton and a fool. If he'd had a finer, more honest and honourable death, legends would have sprung up around him. But he didn't merit a legend."
"Death is always the same."
"Not always."
The half-elf turned his head, trying to catch a glimpse of Geralt's eyes, shaded by his hood.
"Not always, I assure you. I presume you dealt the mortal blow."
Geralt didn't reply. He felt the overwhelming urge to grab the crossbreed by the ponytail, knock him to the floor and wring every detail out of him, knocking his teeth out one by one with his sword pommel. He held himself back. Good sense suggested Angoulême's hoax might bear better results.
"As you wish," said Skiru, not getting an answer. "I won't insist on the report about the course of events.
It's clearly difficult for you to talk about it, and there's clearly not very much to boast about. Supposing, of course, that your silence doesn't stem from something quite different. For example, that nothing at all occurred. Do you perhaps have any proof of the veracity of your words?
We cut off the witch's right hand, Angoulême replied impassively. But later, a raccoon took it and devoured it.
So we have only this.
Geralt slowly unbuttoned his shirt and drew out his medallion with the wolf's head.
The witcher wore it around his neck. May I?
Geralt didn't hesitate for long. The half-elf hefted the medallion in his palm.
Now, I believe, he said slowly, the Gugor emanates powerful magic. Only a witcher could have had something like this.
And the witcher, Angoulême continued, wouldn't have let it be taken from him while he was still breathing. It's rock-solid evidence, so slap the cash on the table, maester.
Shkiru carefully put the medallion away, took a wad of papers from his bosom, put them down on the table and spread them out with a hand.
Over here, please.
Angoulême hopped off the crate and walked over, mocking him and swinging her hips. She leaned over the table. As quick as a flash, Skiru grabbed her hair, slammed her down on the table, and shoved a knife to her throat. The girl didn't even have time to cry out. Geralt and Kaer already had their swords in their hands, but it was too late. The half-elf's assistants, the muscle men with low foreheads, were holding iron hooks, but they were in no hurry to come closer.
Drop your swords, Skiru snarled. Both of you, swords on the floor, or I'll widen the slut's smile.
Don't listen, Angoulême began, and ended with a shriek as the half-elf ground his fist into her hair and scored her skin with a dagger. A glistening, red, wavy line trickled down the girl's neck.
Swords on the ground. I'm serious.
Perhaps we could talk this out.
Geralt, heedless of the rage seething inside him, decided to stall for time.
Like civilized folk.
The half-elf laughed venomously.
Talk it out. With you, witcher? I was sent here to finish you off, not talk. Yes, yes, freak. You were lying, putting on a song and dance, but I recognized you the moment I saw you. You'd been described precisely to me. Can you guess who described you so precisely? Who gave me precise instructions about where and in what company I'd find you? Oh, I'm certain you've guessed.
Release the girl.
But I don't just know you from the description, Skiru continued, with no intention of releasing Angoulême. I've seen you before. I even tracked you once, in Temeria, in July. I followed you on horseback to the town of Dorian and to the chambers of the jurists Codringer and Fenn. Ring any bells?
Geralt twisted his sword so that the blade flashed in the half-elf's eyes.
I wonder, he said icily, how you mean to get out of this stalemate, Skiru? I see two solutions. The first, you let go of the girl right away. The second, you kill the girl, and a second later your blood paints the walls and ceiling a pretty red.
Your weapons!
Skiru brutally yanked Angoulême's hair. We'll be lying on the ground before I count to three. Then I start butchering the slut. We'll see how much you manage to cut off. Not much, I reckon. One, two!
Geralt had begun his own reckoning, whirling the sile in a hissing moulinet.
The thudding of hooves, the neighing and snorting of horses, and yelling reached them from outside.
And what now? Skiru laughed. That's what I was waiting for. It's not stalemate, but checkmate. My friends have arrived.
Really? Said Kaer, looking out through the window. I see the uniforms of the Imperial Light Horse.
Checkmate indeed, but against you, said Geralt. You lose, Skiru. Release the girl.
Like hell.
The barrack doors yielded to kicks, and about a dozen men entered, most of them in identical black uniforms. They were led by a fair-haired, bearded man with a silver bear on his spaulder.
Quit Ian's witches, he asked menacingly. What's going on here? Who answers for this brawl? For the bodies in the yard, speak up this minute. Commander, Gladivian Vort, drop your swords.
They obeyed, for crossbows and arbalests were being aimed at them. Released by Skiru, Angoulême meant to spring up from the table, but suddenly found herself in the grasp of a stocky, colourfully dressed bruiser with bulging frog eyes. She tried to cry out, but the bruiser clamped a gloved fist over her mouth. Let's abstain from violence, Geralt suggested coolly to the commander with the bear. We aren't criminals.
Well, I never.
We're acting with the knowledge and permission of Mr. Fulco Arteveldi, the prefect of Riedbrunner.
Well, I never, repeated the bear,
signalling for Geralt and Kaia's swords to be picked up and confiscated.
With the knowledge and permission of Mr. Fulco Arteveldi, the esteemed Mr. Arteveldi, hear that, lads?
His men, those dressed in the black and colourful clothes, cackled in unison. Angoulême struggled in the grip of Frog Eyes, vainly trying to scream. Needlessly, Geralt already knew. Even before the smiling Skiru began to shake the hand proffered to him, even before the four black-uniformed Nilfgaardians seized Kaer and three others, aimed their crossbows straight at his face. Frog Eyes pushed Angoulême into the arms of his comrades. The girl sagged in their grasp like a rag doll. She didn't even try to offer any resistance. The bear walked slowly over to Geralt and suddenly slammed him in the crotch with his armored-gloved fist. Geralt bent over but didn't fall. Cold fury kept him on his feet.
Then the news that you aren't the first asses to be used by one-eyed Fulca for his own purposes may console you, said the bear. Profitable business deals like the one I'm carrying out here with Mr. Homer Stragen, known by some as Nightingale, are a thorn in his side. It pisses Fulco off that I've recruited Homer Stragen into the Imperial Service and appointed him commander of the Volunteer Mines Defense Company to expedite those deals. Unable thus to avenge himself officially, he hires a variety of rogues.
And witches, a smiling Skiru interjected scathingly.
Outside, said the bear loudly. Five bodies are getting soaked in the rain. You murdered men in the Imperial Service. You disrupted the work of this mine. I have no doubt about it. You're spies, saboteurs, and terrorists. Martial law applies here. I hereby summarily sentence you to death.
Frog Eyes cackled. He walked over to Angoulême, who was being held up by the bandits, grasped one of her breasts and squeezed it hard.
Well then, flaxen hair, he croaked.
And it transpired that his voice was more frog-like than his eyes. His bandit sobriquet, assuming he'd christened himself with it, showed a sense of humour. But if it was an alias intended to disguise, it was extremely effective.
We meet again, then,
the frog-like nightingale croaked, pinching Angoulême in the breast.
Happy?
The girl groaned in pain.
Where are the pearls and stones you stole from me, you whore?
One-eyed Fulco took them for safekeeping,
Angoulême yelled, ineffectually pretending that she wasn't afraid. Go and claim them back! Nightingale croaked and goggled his eyes. Now he looked like a genuine frog, which any moment would start catching flies with its tongue. He pinched Angoulême even harder. She struggled and groaned even more pathetically. Through the red fog of fury covering Geralt's eyes, the girl had once again begun to resemble Ciri.
Take them, the bear ordered impatiently. To the yard with them. He's a witcher, said one of the bandits from Nightingale's Mines Defense Company, hesitantly. He's a hard case. How can we take him with our bare hands? He's liable to cast a charm on us or something else.
No fear. A smiling Skiru patted his pocket. Without his witch's amulet, he's unable to work magic, and I have it.
Take him.
There were more armed Nilfgaardians in black cloaks in the yard, and more of Nightingale's colourful hassa. A clutch of miners had also gathered. The ubiquitous children and dogs were also milling around. Nightingale suddenly lost control of himself, quite as though a devil had possessed him. Croaking furiously, he punched Angoulême, and when she fell, kicked her repeatedly. Geralt strained in the grip of the bandits and was hit on the back of the neck with something hard for his pains.
They said,
croaked Nightingale, hopping over Angoulême like a frantic toad,
that you'd had a stake shoved up your backside in Riedbrunner, you little strumpet. You were destined for the stake then, and to expire on the stake today. Boys, find a post and sharpen it to a spike. Look lively.
Mr. Stragan,
the bear grimaced.
I see no reason to indulge in such a time-consuming and bestial execution. The prisoners ought simply to be hanged.
He fell silent under the evil gaze of the frog-like eyes.
Be quiet, Captain, croaked the bandit. I pay you too much for you to make improper remarks. I promised Angoulême a foul death, and now I'm going to deliver it. Hang those two if you must. I'm not bothered about them.
But I am, Shkiru interrupted. I need them both, especially the Witcher, especially him. And since skewering the girl will take some time, I shall make use of it. He walked over and fixed his feline eyes on Geralt. You ought to know, freak, he said, that it was I that dispatched your comrade, Codringer, in Dorian. I did it on the orders of my lord, Master Vilgefortz, whom I served for many years, but I did it with immense pleasure. The old rogue, Codringer, the half-elf continued, without getting a reaction, had the audacity to stick his nose into Master Vilgefortz's affairs. I guarded him with a knife, and I torched that loathsome monstrosity Fen among his papers and roasted him alive. I could have simply stabbed him, but I devoted a little time and effort to listen to his howling and squealing. And howl and squeal he did, I swear, like a stuck piglet. There was nothing, absolutely nothing human in that howling. Do you know why I'm telling you all this? Because I could also simply knife you or order you stabbed to death. But I shall put in a little time and effort and listen as you howl. You said death is always the same? You'll soon see it isn't. Hey, boys, heat up some pitch in the tar kettle and fetch a chain.
Something smashed against the corner of the barracks and exploded with a red flash and a frightful crash. A second vessel containing petroleum, Geralt recognized it by the smell, landed plumb in the tar kettle, and a third shattered just beside the men restraining the horses. It boomed and belched fire, and the horses fell into a frenzy. There was a turmoil, and from it rushed a howling dog in flames. One of Nightingale's bandits suddenly spread his arms and keeled over in the mud, with an arrow in his back.
Long live the Free Slopes!
Figures in grey mantles and fur hats loomed at the top of the hill on the scaffoldings and the catwalks. More missiles, trailing wakes of flames and smoke behind them like fireworks, fell onto the people, horses and mine buildings. Two flew into the workshop, onto the floor strewn with shavings and sawdust.
Long live the Free Slopes! Death to the Nilfgaardian invaders!
Arrow fletchings and crossbow bolts sang. One of the black-uniformed Nilfgaardians tumbled down under his horse. One of Nightingale's bandits fell with his throat pierced, and one of the close-cropped muscle men dropped with a bolt in his nape. The bear sprawled with a ghastly groan. An arrow had hit him in the chest, under the sternum, beneath the gorget. The arrow had been stolen, though no one could have known that, from a military convoy and was standard issue of the Imperial Army, slightly adapted. The wide, two-bladed arrowhead had been filed in several places with the aim of fragmentation. The arrowhead fragmented beautifully in the bear's guts.
Down with the tyrant Emir! The Free Slopes!
Nightingale croaked, grabbing his arm grazed by a bolt. One of the children rolled over in the mud, pierced through by an arrow from one of the less accurate freedom fighters. One of the men holding Geralt dropped. One of the men holding Angoulême fell over. The girl wrested herself free of the second, drew a knife from her boot in an instant, swung hard and slashed. In her frenzy, she missed Nightingale's throat, but mutilated his cheek splendidly, almost down to the teeth. Nightingale croaked more gratingly than usual, and his eyes bulged more bulgingly. He slumped to his knees, blood spurting between hands, clutching his face. Angoulême gave an unearthly scream and leapt forward to finish the job, but couldn't, for another bomb exploded between her and Nightingale, belching fire and clouds of foul-smelling smoke. Fire roared all around, and a fiery pandemonium raged. Horses thrashed, whinnied and kicked. The bandits and Nilfgaardians yelled. The miners ran in a panic. Some fled and others tried to put out the blazing buildings. Geralt had managed to pick up his sail, which the bear had released. He jabbed it into the forehead of a tall woman in a chainmail vest who was aiming a blow at Angoulême with a morning star as she rose to her feet. He sliced open the thigh of a black-uniformed Nilfgaardian running at him with a half-pike. He then slashed the throat of the next one, who simply happened to be in the way. Right alongside him, a frantic, scorched horse, rushing blindly, knocked over and trampled another child.
Seize the horse! Seize the horse!
Kair was now right beside him, and created room for them both with great swings of his sword. Geralt wasn't listening or looking. He slew another Nilfgaardian. He looked around for Skiru. Angoulême, on bended knee, shot a crossbow she'd picked up, sending the bolt, at a distance of 3 paces, into the belly of a bandit from the mine's defence company who was coming for her. Then she sprang to her feet and hung onto the bridle of a horse running by. "Grab one of them, Geralt!" Kair yelled. "And ride!" The Witcher slit open another Nilfgaardian from breastbone to hip with a downward stroke. He shook blood from his eyebrows and eyelashes with a sharp jerk of his head.
"Skiru, where are you, you bastard?"
A stroke, a cry, warm drops on his face.
"Mercy!"
howled a lad in a black uniform, kneeling in the mud. The Witcher hesitated.
"Wake up!"
yelled Kair, grabbing him by the shoulders and shaking him hard.
"Control yourself. Are you in a frenzy?"
Angoulême was returning at a gallop, dragging another horse by the reins. She was being followed by 2 riders. One of them fell, hit by the arrow of a fighter for the freedom of the slopes. The other was hurled from the saddle by Kair's sword. Geralt leapt into the saddle. And then he saw Skiru in the light of the blaze, summoning the panicked Nilfgaardians to himself. Beside the half-elf, Nightingale, croaking and bawling out curses with his bloody maw, looked like a veritable cannibal troll. Geralt roared furiously, reined his horse around, and whirled his sword. Beside him, Kair shouted and swore, wobbling in the saddle, blood from his forehead pouring over his eyes and face.
"Geralt! Help me!"
Skiru had gathered a group around him, and was yelling and ordering them to shoot their crossbows. Geralt slapped his horse on the rump with the flat of his sword, ready for a suicidal charge. Skiru had to die. Nothing else meant anything, or mattered. Kair meant nothing. Angoulême meant nothing.
"Geralt!" Angoulême yelled. "Help, Kair!"
He came to his senses, and was ashamed. Geralt held Kair up, supported him. Kair wiped his eyes with a sleeve, and the blood instantly poured over them again.
"It's nothing. A scratch."
His voice shook.
"Ride, Witcher. Follow Angoulême. Ride."
From the foot of the mountain came a great cry, and a crowd armed with picks, crowbars, and axes came rushing out. For miners from the neighbouring mines of Common Cause and Lucky Pit were hurrying to help their mates and comrades from the Rialto Colliery. Or from some other. Who could possibly know? Geralt kicked his horse with his heels. They rode at a gallop, recklessly, ventre à terre. They pounded on, not looking back, hugging their horses' necks. Angoulême had landed the best horse, a small but fleet and sturdy bandit steed. Geralt's horse, a bay with Nilfgaardian trappings, was beginning to snort and wheeze and was having difficulty holding its head up. Kair's horse, also an army beast, was stronger and tougher. But what of that when its rider was causing problems, swaying in the saddle, mechanically clenching with his thighs and bleeding profusely onto his mount's mane and neck? But they galloped on. Angoulême, who had pulled ahead, was waiting for them on a bend, in a place where the road went downhill, winding amongst rocks.
"Our pursuers," she panted, smearing dirt on her face, "will come after us. They won't give up. The miners saw which way we fled. We oughtn't to stay on the highway. We have to head into the forests, get off the road, lose them."
"No," the Witcher protested, anxiously listening to the sounds coming from the horse's lungs.
"We must stay on the highway. Take the straightest and shortest route to Sans Retour."
"Why?"
"There's no time to talk. Let's ride. Squeeze what you can from the horses."
They galloped on. The Witcher's bay wheezed. The bay wasn't fit to ride any further. It was barely walking, legs as stiff as boards, panting hard, the air escaping from it in a hoarse wheezing. It finally fell over on its side, kicked stiffly, looked at its rider, and there was reproach in its cloudy eye. Kair's horse was in somewhat better shape, but Kair's condition was worse. He simply fell from the saddle, raised himself, but only onto his hands and knees, and retched spasmodically, though his stomach was empty.
When Geralt and Angoulême tried to touch his bloodied head, he screamed.
"Damn it," said the girl. "It's quite a haircut they've given him."
The skin of the young Nilfgaardian's forehead and temple, along with the hair, was detached from the skull along a considerable length. Were it not for the fact that the blood had formed a sticky clot, the loose patch would probably have fallen off all the way to his ear. It was a gruesome sight.
How did that happen?
They threw a hatchet right at him. To make it even funnier, it wasn't an Nilfgaardian, nor any of Nightingale's men, but one of the quarrymen.
Doesn't matter who threw it.
The Witcher bound Kair's head tightly with a torn-off shirt sleeve. It matters, luckily, that he was a poor shot, and that he just scalped him rather than smashing his skull in. But Kair took a hefty whack in the pate, and the brain felt it too. He won't stay upright in the saddle, even if the horse could bear his weight.
What shall we do then? Your horse has died, his is almost dead, and the sweat's dropping off mine. And they're on our trail. We can't stay here.
We have to stay here. Me and Kair, and Kair's horse. You ride on, hard. Your horse is strong, it can withstand the gallop, and even were you to exhaust it. Angoulême, somewhere in Sans Retour Valley, Regis, Milva, and Dandelion are waiting for us. They don't know anything of this, and may fall into Skiru's clutches. You have to find them and warn them, and then all four of you must ride as fast as you can to Toussaint. You won't be followed there, I hope.
What about you and Kair?
Angoulême bit her lip.
What will happen to you? Nightingale isn't stupid. When he sees a half-dead, riderless horse, he'll rake over every hollow in the region. And you won't get far with Kair.
Skiru, for he's the one pursuing us, will follow your trail.
Do you think so?
I'm certain. Go.
What will Auntie see when I show up without you?
You'll explain. But not to Milva. To Regis. Regis will know what's to be done. And we...
When Kaye's mop dries a bit harder onto his pate, we'll make for Toussaint. We'll meet up there somehow.
Very well. Don't dally. Get on your horse and ride. Don't let our pursuers get any closer. Don't let them hunt you by sight.
Don't teach your grandmother to suck eggs. Look after yourselves. Farewell.
Farewell, Angoulême.
He didn't move too far from the road. He couldn't deny himself a glance at their pursuers. And in fact, he didn't fear any trouble from them, knowing they wouldn't waste time and would pursue Angoulême. He wasn't mistaken. The riders, who thundered into the pass less than a quarter of an hour later, stopped, admittedly, at the sight of the dead horse, shouted, argued, trotted around the roadside bushes, but returned almost at once to the road to resume their pursuit. They clearly believed that two of the three fugitives were now riding one horse, and it would be possible to catch them quickly if they didn't dawdle. Geralt saw that some of the pursuing horses weren't in the best of shape either. There weren't too many black cloaks of the Nilfgaardian light horse among them. Nightingale's colourful brigands predominated. Geralt couldn't see if Nightingale himself was taking part in the hunt, or if he'd stayed behind to treat his mutilated face. When the hoofbeats of the vanishing pursuers had faded away, Geralt stood up from his hiding place in the bracken, lifted and held up the moaning and groaning Kair.
"The horse is too feeble to bear you. Will you be able to walk?"
The Nilfgaardian made a noise which might as easily have been agreement or disagreement, or something else. But he shuffled forward, and that was the main idea. They went down to the stream bed in the ravine. Kair negotiated the final few yards of the slippery slope in a rather chaotic descent. He crawled to the stream, drank, and poured the icy water copiously over the bandage on his head. The Witcher didn't hurry him. He was breathing heavily himself, gathering his strength. He walked upstream, supporting Kair and pulling the horse at the same time, wading in the water and stumbling on pebbles and fallen tree trunks. After some time, Kair stopped cooperating, stopped shuffling his legs obediently. In fact, he stopped moving them at all, so the Witcher simply dragged him. It was impossible to continue like that, particularly since the stream bed was obstructed by rocks and waterfalls. Geralt grunted and lifted the wounded man onto his back. Neither did pulling the horse make life any easier. When they finally emerged from the ravine, the Witcher simply collapsed on the wet forest floor and lay, panting, completely drained, beside the groaning Kair. He lay there for a long time. His knee had begun to throb again with intense pain. Kair finally started to show signs of life once more, and soon after, astonishingly, got up, swearing and holding his head. They set off. Kair marched bravely at first, then slowed, then slumped down. Geralt heaved him onto his back again and lugged him, grunting, slipping over the stones. Pain shot through his knee and fiery black bees seemed to flash in front of his eyes.
"Just a month ago," Kair moaned from his back. "Who'd have thought you'd be lugging me like this?"
"Quiet, Nilfgaardian. You're heavier when you talk."
When they finally made it to the rocks and the rock walls, it was almost dark. The Witcher didn't look for or find the cave. He fell exhausted by the first opening he came across. Human skulls, ribs, pelvises and other bones were strewn around on the cave floor, but, more importantly, there were also dry branches there. Kair was feverish, trembling and shivering. He endured the sewing of the patch of skin to his skull using twine and a crooked needle manfully and fully conscious, with his faculties intact. The crisis came later, during the night. Geralt lit a fire in the cave, disregarding safety considerations. Actually, outside it was drizzling and a strong wind was blowing, so it was unlikely that anybody was wandering around watching out for the glare of a fire, and he had to keep Kair warm. The fever lasted the entire night. He trembled, moaned and raved. Geralt enjoyed no sleep. He kept the fire burning, and his knee hurt like hell. A young and sturdy fellow, Kair came around the following morning. He was pale and sweaty, and the heat of his fever could still be felt. His chattering teeth somewhat complicated articulation, but what he said was comprehensible, and he spoke lucidly. He was complaining of a headache, a fairly normal symptom for someone whose scalp has been torn from their head by an axe. Geralt divided his time between anxiously catnapping and catching rainwater dripping from the rocks in beakers he had fashioned from birch bark. Thirst was tormenting both him and Kair.
"Geralt?"
"Yes?"
Kair tidied up the wood in the fire using a femur he'd found.
"When we were fighting in the mine, I was scared."
"I know."
"For a moment, it looked as though you'd gone berserk. That nothing mattered to you any longer. Aside from killing."
"I know."
"I was afraid,"
he calmly finished,
"that you'd butcher Skiru to death in your frenzy, and we wouldn't get any information out of a dead man, would we?"
Geralt cleared his throat. He was growing to like the young Nilfgaardian more and more. He was not only brave, but smart, too.
"You did right, sending Angoulême away,"
Kair continued, his teeth chattering only slightly.
"It isn't for girls. Not even for girls like her. We'll sort it out, the two of us. We'll ride down our pursuers. But not in order to slaughter them in a berserker frenzy. What you said about revenge that time, Geralt. Even in vengeance, there must be some method. We'll catch up with that half-elf and force him to tell us where Ciri is."
"Ciri's dead."
"Not true. I don't believe she's dead. And you don't either. Admit it."
"I don't want to believe it."
A gale was whistling outside, and the rain was whispering. It was cozy in the cave.
"Geralt?"
"Yes."
"Ciri's alive. I've had dreams again. Yes. Something happened at the equinox. Something dreadful. Yes, without doubt, I felt and saw it. But she's alive. She's definitely alive. Let's hurry, but not to avenge and murder, to find her."
Yes. Yes, Kaia, you're right. And you?
Don't you have dreams now?
I do, he said bitterly. But seldom since we crossed the Yeruga. And I remember nothing after waking. Something has ended in me, Kaia. Something has burned out. Something has ruptured in me.
Never mind, Geralt. I shall dream for both of us.
They set off at dawn. It had stopped raining. It even seemed that the sun was trying to find a hole in the greyness enveloping the sky. They rode slowly on the single horse with the Nilfgaardian military trappings. The horse trudged over the pebbles, moving at a walk along the bank of the Sans Retour, the small river leading to Toussaint. Geralt knew the way. He had been there once. A long, long time ago. Much had changed since then. But the valley had not changed, and neither had the Sans Retour stream, which, the further they went, became more and more the river Sans Retour. Neither the Amel Mountains nor the obelisk of the Gorgon, Devil Mountain, had changed. There were certain things that simply didn't change.
A soldier doesn't question his orders, said Kaia, feeling the dressing on his head. Doesn't analyze them, doesn't ponder over them, doesn't wait for them to be explained to him. That's the first thing they teach a soldier where I come from. So you can understand that not for a second did I ever question an order which was issued to me. The thought of why I had to capture a Sintran princess didn't even cross my mind. An order's an order. I was cross, naturally, because I wanted to taste fame, fighting against the knighthood, against the regular army. But working for the intelligence service is also treated as an honour where I come from. If it had only concerned a more taxing task, a more important prisoner. But a girl.
Geralt threw a trout's spine onto the fire. Before nightfall, they had caught enough fish in a stream flowing into the Sans Retour to eat their fill. The trout were spawning and easy to catch. He listened to Kaia's account, and the curiosity in him struggled with a feeling of profound hurt.
It was essentially chance,
Kaia went on, gazing into the flames.
Pure chance. There was, as I found out later, a spy at the Sintran court, a valet.
When we'd captured the city and were preparing to encircle the castle, the spy stole out and gave a sign that he would try to get the princess out of the city. Several squads like mine were formed. By accident, it was my group the men spiriting Ciri away ran into. A chase through the streets began, in a quarter that was already on fire. It was sheer hell. Nothing but the roar of flames, walls of fire. The horses didn't want to go there, and the men, what can I say, were in no hurry to urge them. My subordinates, there were four of them, began to claim I'd gone mad, that I was leading them to their doom. I barely managed to wrest back control. We pursued them through that fiery bedlam and caught up with them. We suddenly had them before us, 5 mounted Sintrans, and a bloody fight began before I could tell them to watch out for the girl, who ended up on the ground at once anyway, as the man who was carrying her perished first. One of my men lifted her up and onto his horse, but he didn't get far, for one of the Sintrans stabbed him through the back. I saw the blade pass an inch from Ciri's head, and she fell in the mud again. She was dazed with fear. I saw her cuddling up to the dead man, saw her trying to crawl under him, like a kitten by its dead mother. He fell silent and swallowed audibly. She didn't even know she was cuddling up to the enemy, to a hated Nilfgaardian. We ended up alone, she and I, he continued a moment later, and all around us, corpses and fire. Ciri was grovelling in a puddle, and the water and blood were beginning to steam. A house collapsed, and I could see very little through the sparks and smoke. The horse wouldn't go any closer. I called to her, appealed to her to come to me. My voice had almost gone, trying to outshout the conflagration. She saw and heard me, but didn't react.
The horse wouldn't move, and I couldn't control it. I had to dismount. There was no way I could lift her with one arm, and I had to hold the reins with the other. The horse was struggling so much it almost threw me. When I lifted her, she began to scream. Then she tensed up and fainted. I wrapped her in my cloak, which I had wetted in a puddle, in mud, muck and blood, and we rode on, straight through the fire. I don't know by what miracle we managed to get out of there, but a breach in the wall suddenly appeared, and we were by the river. Unluckily, it turned out, for it was the spot the fleeing Nordlings had chosen. I discarded my officer's helmet, for they would have recognized me right away by it, even though the wings had burned off. The rest of my clothing was so blackened, it couldn't have betrayed me. But had the girl been conscious, had she screamed, they would have put me to the sword. I was lucky. I rode a few furlongs with them, and then fell back and hid in the bushes by a river, bearing dead bodies. He fell silent, coughed slightly, and felt his bandaged head with both hands, and blushed. Or was it merely the glare of the flames? Ciri was so dirty. I had to undress her. She didn't resist. She didn't scream. She just trembled, eyes closed. Each time I touched her to clean her or dry her, she tensed and stiffened. I ought to have spoken to her, calmed her. But suddenly I couldn't find the words in your language, in my mother's language, which I've known from a child. Unable to find the words, I tried to calm her by touch, by gentleness. But she stiffened and whimpered. Like a baby.
That haunted her in her nightmares, Geralt whispered.
I know. Mine too.
What then?
She fell asleep.
So did I, from fatigue.
When I woke, she wasn't beside me. She was nowhere to be seen. I don't recall the rest.
Those who found me claimed I was running around in circles, howling like a wolf. They had to tie me up. When I'd calmed down, I was taken in hand by intelligence agents, Vatier de Rideau's subordinates. They wanted to know about Cirilla. Where she was, where she fled to, how she gave me the slip, why I let her escape. And again, from the beginning, where was she, where had she fled to? Infuriated, I yelled something about the Emperor hunting a little girl like a sparrowhawk.
For that, I spent a year locked up in the Citadel. But then I was back in grace, for I was needed. On Thanith, they needed someone who spoke the common speech and knew what Ciri looked like. The Emperor wanted me to go to Thanith, and not to fail this time, but bring him Ciri. He was silent for a time. Emir gave me a chance. I could have refused. It would have meant absolute, total, perpetual disfavor and oblivion, but I could have declined if I'd wanted. But I didn't decline. For you see, Geralt, I couldn't forget her. I won't lie to you. I saw her constantly in my dreams, and not as the skinny child she was by the river when I undressed and washed her. I saw her, and I still see her, as a woman. Comely, aware, provocative, with such details as a crimson rose tattooed on her groin.
What are you talking about?
I don't know. I don't know myself. But that's how it has been and is yet. I see her in my dreams, just as I saw her in my dreams back then. That is why I volunteered for the mission to Thanith. That's why I wanted to join you afterwards. I want to see her. Again. I want to touch her hair again. Look into her eyes. I want to gaze on her. Kill me if you will, but I won't pretend any longer. I think I love her. Please
Don't laugh.
I don't feel like laughing.
So that's why I'm riding with you. Do you understand?
Do you want her for yourself or for your emperor?
I'm a realist, he whispered. I mean, she won't want me. But as the emperor's spouse, I could at least see her.
As a realist, the witcher snapped. You should remember, we have to find and rescue her first. Assuming your dreams aren't lying, and Ciri is really still alive.
I'm aware of that. And should we find her, what then?
We shall see. We shall see, Kaia.
Don't deceive me, be frank. You won't let me take her, will you?
He didn't reply.
Kaia didn't repeat the question.
Until then, he asked coolly, may we be comrades?
We may, Kaia. I apologize again for back there. I don't know what came over me. I've never seriously suspected you of treachery or duplicity.
I'm not a traitor. I'll never betray you, Witcher.
They rode along a deep gorge, which the swift-flowing and wide Sandratur, now a river, had carved out of the hills. They rode east towards the border of the Duchy of Tussar. Gorgon, Devil Mountain, rose above them. To look at the summit, they would have had to crane their necks. But they didn't. First, they smelled smoke. Then a moment later, beheld a campfire with spits over it and filleted trout roasting on them. They then beheld a solitary individual sitting beside the fire. Not long before, Geralt would have mocked, mercilessly ridiculed, and thought a complete idiot, anyone who would have dared claim that he, a witcher, would feel great joy at the sight of a vampire.
Oh-ho!
Emil, Regis, Rolehek, Tetsiev, Godifroy, said placidly, adjusting the spits.
Look what the cat dragged in.
The knocker, likewise called a knacker, Koblinau, Butra, Polterduk, Karkurios, Rubatzal or Pushteki, is a form of kobold, which nonetheless, the knocker considerably surpasses in magnitude and strength. The knocker, as a rule, also wears a great beard, which kobolds habitually do not. The knocker dwells in adits, vertical shafts, spoil heaps, precipices, tenebrous hollows, inside rocks, in diverse grottos, caves and stone wildernesses. Wherever it dwells, natural riches such as metal, ore, carbon, salt or petroleum are surely buried in the earth. Thus, one may often encounter a knocker in mines, particularly abandoned ones, although it is also likely to appear in active ones. It is a vicious scourge and pest, a curse and veritable divine retribution for miners and quarrymen whom the vexatious knocker leads astray. By knocking on the rock, it beguiles and frightens, obstructs galleries, steals and spoils mining equipment and all kinds of belongings, and is also inclined to strike one on the head from a place of concealment. But it may be bribed to curb its mischief-making by placing in a dark gallery or shaft some bread and butter, a smoked cheese, or a flitch of smoked gammon. But best of all is a demijohn of alcohol, since the knocker is extremely greedy for such. Physiologus. Chapter 7.
They're safe, assured the vampire, spurring on his mule, Drahul. All three of them, Milva, Dandelion, and, of course, Angoulême,
who drove us into the Sans-Retour Valley just in time and told us everything, not stinting with her colourful expressions. I've never understood why the majority of human curses and insults refer to the erotic sphere. Sex is wonderful and associated with beauty, joy and pleasure. How can the names of the sexual organs be used as a vulgar synonym for...
Drop the subject, Regis, Geralt interrupted.
Of course, I apologize.
Warned by Angoulême about the approaching brigands, we crossed the marches of Tussar without delay. Milva admittedly wasn't overjoyed and was spoiling to turn tail and bring you both aid. I managed to dissuade her. And Dandelion, astonishingly, rather than enjoy the asylum afforded by the borders of the duchy, clearly had his heart in his mouth.
You don't by any chance know what he fears so in Toussaint?
I don't, but I can guess, Geralt replied sourly. It wouldn't be the first place where our dear friend the Bard has been up to no good. He has settled down now somewhat, for he moves in decent society, but nothing was sacred to him in his youth. Only urchins and women who'd climbed to the tops of tall trees were safe from him. Husbands regularly held grudges against the troubadour for unknown reasons. There is doubtless a man in Toussaint for whom the sight of Dandelion will bring back memories. But these are essentially trifling matters. Let's return to the facts. What of our pursuers? I hope...
I don't think... Regis smiled, that they followed us into Toussaint. The border is teeming with errant knights, who are extremely bored and hankering for a fight. Furthermore, we and a group of pilgrims we bumped into on the border ended up in the sacred grove of Myrkvid, and that place is fearsome. Even the pilgrims and infirm people who make for Myrkvid from the most distant corners to be healed stop in the settlement near the forest edge, not daring to go deeper. There are rumours that any who dare enter the sacred oak groves end up burned over a slow flame in the wicker hag. Geralt inhaled.
You mean...
Of course, the vampire interjected again. The druids are in the grove of Myrkvid. The ones who were previously in Caedu, Angryn, later journeyed to Loch Monduin, and finally to Myrkvid in Toussaint. We were fated to find them. Did I say we were? I don't recall. Geralt sighed deeply. Caer, riding at his back, also sighed.
That friend of yours, is he among those druids?
The vampire smiled once more.
Not he, but she, he explained. Indeed, she is. She has even been promoted. She leads the entire circle.
Is she the Hierophantess?
She is the Flaminica. That's the highest druidic title when borne by a woman. Only men may be Hierophants.
True, I'd forgotten.
So, am I to understand that Milva and the rest are now in the care of the Flaminica and her circle?
The vampire, as was his custom, answered the question while it was being asked, after which he set about answering a question not yet asked.
I, however, hurried to meet you, for a mysterious thing occurred. The Flaminica, to whom I began to present our case, didn't let me complete it. She said she knew everything, that she had been anticipating our arrival for some time.
Really?
I couldn't hide my disbelief either.
The vampire reined in the mule, stood up in his stirrups and looked around.
Are you seeking somebody or something? Asked Caer.
I'm no longer searching. I found it. Let's sit down.
I'd prefer to.
Let's sit down. I'll explain everything.
They had to raise their voices to be able to converse over the roar of a waterfall tumbling from a considerable height down the vertical wall of a rocky precipice. Down below, where the waterfall had hollowed out a largish lake, a black cave mouth gaped in the rock. The Witcher stared at it.
Yes, right there,
Regis confirmed the Witcher's suspicion.
I rode here to meet you, for I was instructed to direct you there. You will have to enter that cave. I told you. The druids knew about you, knew about Ciri, knew about our mission, and they learned about it from someone who lives down there. That person, if one is to believe the druidess, wishes to talk to you.
If one is to believe the druidess,
Geralt repeated sneeringly.
I've been in these parts before. I know what dwells in the deep caves beneath Devil Mountain. There are various denizens there, but it's impossible to talk to the vast majority of them, except with a sword. What else did your druidess say? What else am I to believe?
She gave me clearly to understand.
The vampire's black eyes bored into Geralt. That she isn't generally fond of individuals who destroy and kill flora and fauna, and of witchers in particular.
I explained that at the present moment you are more of a titular witcher, that you absolutely don't pester flora or fauna, as long as the aforementioned doesn't pester you. The Flaminica, you ought to know, is an extremely shrewd woman, and noted that you have abandoned witcherhood, not as a result of ideological changes, but because you were compelled to by circumstances. I know very well, she said, that misfortune has befallen a person close to the witcher. the Witcher was thus forced to abandon Witcherhood and go to her rescue. Geralt didn't comment, but his gaze was expressive enough to make the vampire hurry to explain. She declared, and I quote, "The Witcher who is not a Witcher will prove he is capable of humility and sacrifice. He will enter the somber mouth of the earth, unarmed, having laid down all weapons, all sharp iron, all sharp thoughts, all aggression, fury, anger, and arrogance. He will enter in humility. And then, in the abyss, the humble, not Witcher, will find answers to the questions which torment him. He will find answers to many questions. But should the Witcher remain a Witcher, he will find nothing." Geralt spat towards the waterfall and the cave.
"It's a game," he declared. "A jest, a prank, soothsaying sacrifice, mysterious encounters in caverns, answers to questions. You can only encounter such hackneyed devices from ragged wandering storytellers. Somebody's mocking me, at best. And if it's not mockery..."
"I would not call it mockery under any circumstances," Regis said firmly. "None at all, Geralt of Rivia."
"What then is it? One of those notorious druidic peculiarities?"
"We shan't know," Gaia chipped in, "until we find out. Come on, Geralt. We'll enter together." No. The vampire shook his head. The Flaminica was categorical in this respect. The Witcher must enter alone, without a weapon. Give me your sword. I shall look after it during your absence.
To hell with that, Geralt began.
But Regis interrupted his flow of words with a rapid gesture. Give me your sword. He held out a hand. And if you have any other weapons, leave them with me too. Remember the Flaminica's words. No aggression. Sacrifice. Humility.
Do you know who I will encounter down there? Who, or what, is waiting for me in that cave?
No, I don't. Various creatures inhabit the subterranean corridors beneath Gorgon.
I may be struck down.
The vampire softly cleared his throat. That cannot be ruled out, he said gravely. But you must take that risk. I know you will, of course. Geralt was not disappointed. As he had expected, the entrance to the cave was filled with an impressive heap of skulls, ribs, tibulas, and other bones. There was no stench of putrefaction, however. The mortal remains were clearly ancient and functioned as decorations intended to scare away intruders. At least, so he thought. He entered the darkness, and the bones crunched and grated beneath his feet. His vision quickly adjusted to the gloom. He was in a gigantic cave, a rocky cavern whose dimensions the eye was unable to take in, for its proportions broke up and vanished in the forest of stalactites suspended from the ceiling in striking festoons. Stalagmites, stocky and squat at the base, becoming slender towards the top, rose white and pink from the colourful shimmering gravel glistening with water on the cave floor. Some of their points reached well above the witch's head. Some of them were fused with stalactites, forming columns of stalagnates. No one called out. The only audible sounds were from the water, which echoed as it splashed and dripped. He walked on, slowly, straight ahead into the gloom, between the columns of stone. He knew he was being watched. He felt the lack of the sword on his back intensely, importunately and distinctly, like the lack of his recently knocked out tooth. He slowed. What a moment earlier he had taken as rounded boulders lying at the foot of some stalagmites now goggled great glowing eyes at him. Great maws opened and conical fangs flashed in the matted mass of grey and brown, shaggy, dust-covered hair. Barbigazis. He walked slowly and stepped cautiously. Barbigazis of all sizes were everywhere. They lay in his way with no intention of yielding. Though they had behaved extremely peacefully until that moment, he was nonetheless uncertain as to what would happen if he trod on one of them.
The stalagmites were like a forest, so there was no way of walking straight. He had to weave around them. Above, water dripped from the ceiling, bristling with needles of stalactites. The barbigazis, more and more of them were appearing, accompanied him as he walked, waddling and rolling over the cave floor. He could hear their monotonous babbling and puffing. He smelled their pungent, sour scent. He had to stop. In his way, between two stalagmites, in a place he couldn't pass around, lay a large echinops, bristling with masses of long spines. Geralt swallowed. He knew only too well that the echinops was capable of shooting its spines a distance of 10 feet. The spines had a peculiar property. Once stuck into the body, they broke off, and the sharp tips penetrated and worked their way in deeper and deeper until they finally reached a sensitive organ.
"Stupid witcher," he heard in the gloom. "Cowardly witcher, he's frit."
The voice sounded odd and weird, but Geralt had heard similar voices many times. Creatures not accustomed to communicating using articulated speech spoke like that. They accented and intoned strangely, drawing out the syllables unnaturally.
"Stupid witcher! Stupid witcher!"
He refrained from comment. He bit his lip and carefully moved past the echinops. The monster's spines swayed like a sea anemone's tentacles. But only for a moment. Then the echinops stopped moving and once again seemed nothing more than a clump of bog grass. Two immense barbigazis waddled across his path, jabbering and growling. From the ceiling came the flapping of webbed wings and a hissing cackle, unerringly signalling the presence of vampyroids and vespertils.
"He's come here, a murderer, a killer, a witcher."
The same voice which had spoken previously reverberated in the gloom.
"He's come down here. He dead. But he has no sword, the killer. So how means he to kill? With his gaze?" "Or maybe,"
came a second voice, with even more unnatural articulation,
"we kill him."
The barbigazis babbled in a noisy chorus. One of them, as large as a mature pumpkin, rolled closer and closer and snapped its teeth right by Geralt's heels. The witcher stifled the curse, pressing itself against his lips, and walked on. Water dripped from the stalactites, jingling with a silvery echo. Something seized his leg. He refrained from pushing it roughly away. The strange creature was small, not much larger than a Pekingese dog. It resembled a Pekingese a little too, at least its face did. The rest of it was like a small monkey. Geralt had no idea what it was. He'd never seen anything like it.
"Witcher!"
sang the almost Pekingese, in a high-pitched voice, but quite distinctly, clutching Geralt's boot.
"Witcher! Bastard!"
"Get off," he said through clenched teeth. "Get off my boot, or I'll kick your ass."
The barbigazis babbled louder, more urgently and menacingly. Something lowed in the darkness. Geralt didn't know what it was. It sounded like a cow, but the witcher bet it wasn't.
"Witcher the bastard!"
"Let go of my boot," he repeated, fighting to control himself. "I came here, unarmed, in peace. You're bothering me."
He broke off and choked on a wave of repellent feta, making his eyes water and his hair curl. The strange Pekingese-like creature digging into his calf goggled and defecated right on his boot. The hideous stink was accompanied by even more hideous noises. He swore appropriately to the situation and shoved the aggressive creature away with his foot, much more gently than he should have, but what he was expecting happened anyway.
"He kicked the little one!"
Something roared in the darkness, above the literally thunderous jabbering and howling of the Barbagatzis.
"He kicked the little one! He harmed something smaller than himself!"
The nearest Barbagatzis rolled right over to his feet. He felt the gnarled and steely claws grabbing and immobilizing him.